This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Miette of Miette's Bedtime Story Podcast. Moll Flanders by Daniel Defoe. Section 10. We lived thus near 2 years, only with this exception, that he went 3 times to London in that time, and once he continued there 4 months. But, to do him justice, he always supplied me with money to subsist me very handsomely. Had we continued thus, I confess we had had much to boast of. But, as wise men say, it is ill venturing too near the brink of a command, so we found it. And here again I must do him the justice to own that the first breach was not on his part. It was one night that we were in bed together warm and merry, and having drunk, I think, a little more wine that night, both of us, than usual, although not in the least to disorder either of us, when, after some other follies which I cannot name, and being clasped close in his arms, I told him, I repeat it with shame and horror of soul, that I could find in my heart to discharge him of his engagement for one night, and no more. He took me at my word immediately, and after that there was no resisting him. Neither indeed had I any mind to resist him any more, let what would come of it. Thus the government of our virtue was broken, and I exchanged the place of friend for that unmusical, harsh-sounding title of whore. In the morning, we were both at our penitentials. I cried very heartily. He expressed himself very sorry. But that was all either of us could do at the time. And the way being thus cleared, and the bars of virtue and conscience thus removed, we had the less difficult afterwards to struggle with. It was but a dull kind of conversation that we had together for all the rest of the week. I looked on him with blushes, and every now and then started that melancholy objection. What if I should be with child now? What will become of me then? He encouraged me by telling me that as long as I was true to him, he would be so to me. And since it was gone such a length, which indeed he never intended, yet if I was with child, he would take care of that, and of me too. This hardened us both. I assured him that if I was with child, I would die for want of a midwife rather than name him as the father of it, and he assured me I should never want if I should be with child. These mutual assurances hardened us in the thing, and after this we repeated the crime as often as we pleased. Till at length, as I had feared, so it came to pass, and I was indeed with child. After I was sure it was so, and I had satisfied him of it too, we began to think of taking measures for the managing it, and I proposed trusting the secret to my landlady and asking her advice, which he agreed to. My landlady, a woman, as I found, used to such things, made light of it. She said she knew it would come to that at last, and made us very merry about it. As I said above, we found her an experienced old lady at such work. She undertook everything, engaged to procure a midwife and a nurse, to satisfy all inquiries, and bring us off with reputation. And she did so very dexterously indeed. When I grew near my time, she desired my gentleman to go away to London, or make as if he did so. When he was gone, she acquainted the parish officers that there was a lady ready to lie in at her house, but that she knew her husband very well, and gave them, as she pretended, an account of his name, which she called Sir Walter Cleeve, telling them he was a very worthy gentleman, and that she would answer for all inquiries and the like. This satisfied the parish officers presently, and I lay in with as much credit as I could have done if I had really been my Lady Cleeve, and was assisted in my travail by three or four of the best citizens' wives of Bath, who lived in the neighbourhood, which, however, made me a little more expensive to him. I often expressed my concern about it, but he bid me not to be concerned about it. As he had furnished me very sufficiently with money for the extraordinary expenses of my lying in, I had everything very handsome about me, but did not affect to be gay or extravagant neither. Besides, knowing my own circumstances, and knowing the world as I had done, and that such kind of things do not often last long, I took care to lay up as much money as I could for a wet day, as I called it, making him believe it was all spent upon the extraordinary appearance of things in my lying in. By this means, and including what he had given me above, I had, at the end of my lying in, about 200 guineas by me, including also what was left of my own. I was brought to bed of a fine boy indeed, and a charming child it was. And when he heard of it, he wrote me a very kind, obliging letter about it, and then told me he thought it would look better for me to come away for London as soon as I was up and well, that he had provided apartments for me at Hammersmith, and if I came thither only from London, and then after a little while I should go back to the Bath, and he would go with me. I liked this offer very well, and accordingly hired a coach on purpose, and taking my child and a wet nurse to tend and suckle it, and a maid-servant with me, away I went for London. He met me at Reading in his own chariot, and taking me into that, left the servant and the child in the hired coach, and so he brought me to my new lodgings at Hammersmith, with which I had abundance of reason to be very well pleased, for they were very handsome rooms, and I was very well accommodated. And now I was indeed in the height of what I might call my prosperity, and I wanted nothing but to be a wife, which, however, could not be in this case. There was no room for it, and therefore on all occasions I studied to save what I could, as I have said above, against a time of scarcity, knowing well enough that such things as these do not always continue, that men that keep mistresses often change them, grow weary of them, or jealous of them, or something or other happens to make them withdraw their bounty, and sometimes the ladies that are thus well used are not careful by a prudent conduct to preserve the esteem of their persons, or the nice article of their fidelity, and then they are justly cast off with contempt. But I was secured in this point, for as I had no inclination to change, so I had no manner of acquaintance in the whole house, and so no temptation to look any farther. I kept no company but in the family when I lodged, and with the clergyman's lady at next door, so that when he was absent I visited nobody, nor did he ever find me out of my chamber or parlour when he came down. If I went anywhere to take the air, it was always with him. The living in this manner with him, and his with me, was certainly the most undesigned thing in the world. He often protested to me that when he first became acquainted with me, and even to the very night when we first broke in upon our rules, he never had the least design of lying with me, that he always had a sincere affection for me, but not the least real inclination to do what he had done. I assured him I never suspected him, that if I had, I should not so easily have yielded to the freedom which brought it on, but that it was all a surprise, and was owing to the accident of our having yielded too far to our mutual inclinations that night. And indeed, I have often observed since, and leave it as a caution to the readers of this story, that we ought to be cautious of gratifying our inclinations in loose and lewd freedoms, lest we find our resolutions of virtue fail us in this junction when their assistance should be most necessary. It is true, and I have confessed it before, that from the first hour I began to converse with him, I resolved to let him lie with me if he offered it. But it was because I wanted his help and assistance, and I knew no other way of securing him than that. But when were that night together, and, as I have said, had gone such a length, I found my weakness. The inclination was not to be resisted, but I was obliged to yield up all, even before he asked it. However, he was so just to me that he never upbraided me with that, nor did he ever express the least dislike of my conduct on any other occasion, but always protested he was as much delighted with my company as he was the first hour we came together. I mean, came together as bedfellows. It is true that he had no wife, that is to say, she was as no wife to him, and so I was in no danger that way, but the just reflections of conscience oftentimes snatch a man, especially a man of sense, from the arms of a mistress, as it did him at last, though on another occasion. On the other hand, though I was not without secret reproaches of my own conscience for the life I led, and that even in the greatest height of the satisfaction I ever took, yet I had the terrible prospect of poverty and starving which lay on me as a frightful spectre, so that there was no looking behind me. But as poverty brought me into it, so fear of poverty kept me in it, and I frequently resolved to leave it quite off if I could, but come to lay up money enough to maintain me. But these were thoughts of no weight, and whenever he came to me they vanished, for his company was so delightful that there was no being melancholy when he was there. The reflections were all the subject of those hours when I was alone. I lived 6 years in this happy but unhappy condition, in which time I brought him 3 children. But only the first of them lived, and though I removed twice in those 6 years, yet I came back in the 6th year to my first lodgings at Hammersmith. Here it was that I was one morning surprised with a kind but melancholy letter from my gentleman, intimating that he was very ill, and was afraid he should have another fit of sickness, but that his wife's relations being in the house with him, it would not be practicable to have me with him, which, however, he expressed his great satisfaction in, and that he wished I could be allowed to tend and nurse him as I did before. I was very much concerned at this account, and was very impatient to know how it was with him. I waited a fortnight or thereabouts, and heard nothing, which surprised me, and I began to be very uneasy indeed. I think I may say that for the next fortnight I was near to distracted. It was my particular difficulty that I did not know directly where he was, for I understood at first he was in the lodgings of his wife's mother, but having removed myself to London, I soon found, by the help of the direction I had for writing my letters to him, how to inquire after him, and there I found that he was at a house in Bloomsbury, whither he had, a little before he fell sick, removed his whole family, and that his wife and wife's mother were in the same house, though the wife was not suffered to know that she was in the same house with her husband. Here I also soon understood that he was at the last extremity, which made me almost at the last extremity too, to have a true account. One night I had the curiosity to disguise myself like a servant maid, in a round cap and straw hat, and went to the door as sent by a lady of its neighbourhood, where he lived before, and giving master and mistress's service, I said I was sent to know how Mr. did, and how he had rested that night. In delivering this message I got the opportunity I desired, for, speaking with one of the maids, I held a long gossip's tale with her, and had all the particulars of his illness, which I found was a pleurisy, attended with a cough and a fever. She told me also who was in the house, and how his wife was, who, by her relation, they were in some hopes might recover her understanding. But as to the gentleman himself, in short, she told me the doctors said there was very little hopes of him, that in the morning they thought he had been dying, and that he was but little better then, for they did not expect that he could live over the next night. This was heavy news for me, and I began now to see an end of my prosperity, and to see also that it was very well I had played to good housewife and secured or saved something while he was alive, for that now I had no view of my own living before me. It lay very heavy upon my mind, too, that I had a son, a fine lovely boy about 5 years old, and no provision made for it, at least that I knew of. With these considerations, and a sad heart, I went home for that evening, and began to cast with myself how I should live, and in what manner to bestow myself for the residue of my life. You may be sure that I could not rest without inquiring again very quickly what was become of him, and not venturing to go myself, I sent several sham messengers, until after a fortnight's waiting longer, I found that there was hopes of his life. Though he was still very ill, then I abated my sending any more to the house. And in some time after I learned in the neighbourhood that he was about house, and then that he was abroad again. I made no doubt then but that I should hear soon of him, and began to comfort myself with my circumstances, being, as I thought, recovered. I waited a week and 2 weeks, and with much surprise and amazement I waited near 2 months, and heard nothing but that, being recovered, he was gone into the country for the air, and for the better recovery after his distemper. After this it was yet 2 more months, and then I understood he was come to his city house again, but still I heard nothing from him. I had written several letters for him, and directed them as usual, and found 2 or 3 of them had been called for, but not the rest. I wrote again in a more pressing manner than ever, and in one of them let him know that I must be forced to wait on him myself, representing my circumstances, the rent of lodgings to pay, and the provision for the child wanting, and my own deplorable condition destitute of subsistence for his most solemn engagement to take care of and provide for me. I took a copy of this letter, and finding it lay at the house near a month and was not called for, I found means to have the copy of it put into his own hands at a coffee-house, where I had by inquiry found he used to go. This letter forced an answer from him, by which, though I found I was to be abandoned, Yet I found he had sent a letter to me some time before, desiring me to go down to the bath again. Its contents I shall come to presently. It is true that sick beds are the time when such correspondences as these are looked on with different countenances, as seen with other eyes than we saw them with, or than they appeared with before. My lover had been at the gates of death, and at the very brink of eternity, and, it seems, had been struck with a due remorse, and with sad reflections upon his past life of gallantry and levity, and among the rest criminal correspondence with me, which was neither more nor less than a long-continued life of adultery, and represented itself as it really was, not as it had been formerly thought by him to be. And he looked upon it now with a just and religious abhorrence. I cannot but observe also, and leave it for the direction of my sex in such cases of pleasure, that whenever sincere repentance succeeds such a crime as this, there never fails to attend a hatred of the object. And the more the affection might seem to be before, the hatred will be more in proportion. It will always be so. Indeed, it can be no otherwise, for there cannot be a true and sincere abhorrence of the offence, and the love to the cause of it remain. There will, with an abhorrence of the sin, be found a detestation of the fellow sinner. You can expect no other. I found it so here, through good manners and justice in this gentleman, kept him from carrying it on to the extreme, but the short history of his part in this affair was thus. He perceived, by my last letter, and by all the rest which he went for after, that I was not gone to Bath, that his first letter had not come to my hand, upon which he writes to me this following. "Madam, I am surprised that my letter, dated the 8th of last month, did not come to your hand. I give you my word it was delivered at your lodgings, and to the hands of your maid. I need not acquaint you with what has been my condition for some time past, and how, having been at the edge of the grave, I am, by the unexpected and undeserved mercy of heaven, restored again. In the condition I have been in, it cannot be strange to you that our unhappy correspondence had not been the least of the burdens which lay upon my conscience. I need say no more. Those things that must be repented of must also be reformed. I wish you would think of going back to the bath. I enclose you here a bill for £50 for clearing yourself at your lodgings and carrying you down, and hope it will be no surprise to you to add that on this account only, and not for any offence given me on your side, I can see you no more. I will take due care of the child, leave him where he is, or take him with you, as you please. I wish you like the reflections, and that they may be to your advantage. I am, etc." I was struck with this letter as with a thousand wounds, such as I cannot describe. The reproaches of my own conscience were such as I cannot express, for I was not blind to my own crime, and I reflected that I might, with less offence, have continued with my brother and lived with him as a wife, since there was no crime in our marriage on that score, neither of us knowing it. But I never once reflected that I was all this while a married woman, a wife to Mr. the linen-draper, who, though he had left me by the necessity of his circumstances, had no power to discharge me from the marriage contract which was between us, or to give me a legal liberty to marry again, so that I had been no less than a whore and an adulteress all this while. I then reproached myself for the liberties I had taken, and how I had been a snare to this gentleman, and that indeed I was principal in the crime, that now he was mercifully snatched out of the gulf by a convincing work upon his mind, but that I was left as if I was forsaken of God's grace, and abandoned by heaven to a continuing in my wickedness. Under these reflections I continued very pensive and sad for near a month, and did not go down to the bath, having no inclination to be with the woman whom I was with before, lest, as I thought, she should prompt me to some wicked course of life again, as she had done, and besides, I was very loath that she should know I was cast off as above. And now I was greatly perplexed about my little boy. It was death to me to part with a child, and yet when I considered the danger of being, one time or other, left with him to keep without a maintenance to support him, I then resolved to leave him where he was. But then I concluded also to be near him myself too, that I then might have the satisfaction of seeing him without the care of providing for him. I sent my gentleman a short letter, therefore, that I had obeyed his orders in all things but that of going back to the bath, which I could not think of for many reasons, that, however, parting from him was a wound to me that I could never recover. Yet I was fully satisfied his reflections were just, and would be very far from desiring to obstruct his reformation or repentance. Then I represented my own circumstances to him in the most moving terms that I was able. I told him that those unhappy distresses which first moved him to a generous and honest friendship for me would, I hope, move him to a little concern for me now, though the criminal part of our correspondence, which I believed neither of us intended to fall into at the time, was broken off. That I desired to repent as sincerely as he had done, but entreated him to put me in some condition that I might not be exposed to the temptations which the devil never fails to excite us to from the frightful prospect of poverty and distress. And if he had the least apprehensions of my being troublesome to him, I begged he would put me in a posture to go back to my mother in Virginia, from which he knew I came, and that would put an end to all his fears on that account. I concluded that if he would send me £50 more to facilitate my going away, I would send him back a general release, and would promise never to disturb him with any more importunities, unless it was to hear of the well-doing of the child, whom, if I found my mother living and my circumstances able, I would send for to come over with me, and take him also effectually off his hands. This was indeed all a cheat thus far, viz. That I had no intention to go to Virginia, as the account of my former affairs there may convince anybody of, but the business was to get this last £50 off him, if possible, knowing well enough that it would be the last penny I was ever to expect. However, the argument I used, namely, of giving him a general release and never troubling him any more, prevailed effectually with him, and he sent me a bill for the money by a person who brought with him a general release for me to sign, and which I frankly signed, and received the money, and thus, though full sore against my will, a final end was put to this affair. And here I cannot but reflect upon the unhappy consequence of two great freedoms between persons stated as we were, upon the pretence of innocent intentions, love of friendship, and the like, for the flesh has generally so great a share in these friendships that is great odds but inclination prevails at last over the most solemn resolutions, and that vice breaks in at the breaches of decency, which really innocent friendships ought to preserve with the greatest strictness. But I leave the readers of these things to their own just reflections, which they will be more able to make effectual than I, who soon forgot myself, and am therefore but a very indifferent monitor. End of section 10.